It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, a museum without walls where artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversation. In today's show, we're calling Smart Future-Proofing the Intersection of Pedagogy, Technology, and the Arts. And joining us are Thomas Huff, and also is from the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and Loretta Yarlow, I think I have that right, also, and Heather Sharp-Smith. Welcome, you all. It's so great to have you. If you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about each one of you before we get going.
I'm Tom Hoof. I work in the campus planning division at UMass Amherst, and we are the folks who assess needs across the campus, mostly academic needs, in order to budget and plan and think about the future of how to make what we provide to the academics work for their current and future needs.
And I'm Loretta Yarlow. I'm the director, chief curator at the University Museum of Contemporary Art, the UMCA, which is both a teaching museum and a civic museum. We are the only museum that focuses full-time on the art of our time, contemporary art, both in our temporary exhibitions and our permanent collection. And I like to say that we are the only university-affiliated museum that between Boston and the Berkshires that focuses full time on the art of our time.
I'm Heather Sharp-Smith. I'm the executive director of the Instructional Design Engagement and Support Group at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And the job of my team is teaching and learning through technology, or incorporating technology into the curriculum. So I'm right at that intersection of where pedagogy, technology, and even art kind of mix right now.
That's really exciting, Heather. And each one of you brings a unique perspective to this topic. And the topic is kind of broad intentionally, so that we can kind of have a conversation around how structures and buildings, technology, and also objects that we might do in a collection, as well as how we get people to think about that intersection and how we can create that. So Tom, why don't we start with you a little bit? And this is something that you and I have kicked around for a while, the idea of future-proofing, but you have a definite opinion about it.
Yes.
So would you go ahead and do that, please?
I really like the term, but I also, I guess I have a few kind of my own personal caveats about it, because working in the world that I do, which is to create fixed environments where, you spend multiple millions of dollars on a building. I think those of us in the architecture and planning world often say, oh, you can't ever really future-proof any building. So I'm looking at it from the building point of view, and some very interesting experts that I follow said that if you really look at a building embodies more mutable and less mutable pieces. And you might say, the structure and the walls and the exterior of the building don't necessarily need to change much over time. But as you go down in scale into the building, you find that more and more of the pieces inside, for an example, a laboratory, the things that you can't really future-proof, and I think it applies to classrooms too, which we want to talk about a little bit more, things within, like classroom technologies or the parts of laboratories that people actually touch and interact with, are the parts of a building that change the fastest. And so my caveat on future-proofing is I think we're designing buildings that are flexible on my end of this conversation to the extent that they can be used and repurposed in ways that don't require you to rebuild or renovate large parts of it, as long as you can change out the parts that do change quickly. So So I think that's my take on future proofing as far as buildings are concerned.
Heather, I know, you know, that we rapidly, all the universities around the world had to rapidly jump in with both feet into what we had hoped was future proof, but we had to learn a lot and are still learning. How do we take things online? What is your feeling about that term?
You know, it's funny because it's a term that I've been using a lot lately. I'm kind of deeply involved with Tom in looking at buildings and classrooms right now, and what is the next step that we need to take these in? And I think the question I've been asking myself is, you know, what is the classroom now? And what is the classroom turning into? Is it a physical space? Is it the virtual space? What part does technology play in learning? And I'm a believer right now that technology is here to support the social component of learning. So therefore, what should be future-proofed really, I think, is not necessarily the physical space and not necessarily the technology, but our kind of strategic plan of what elements are we going to look at and how often are we going to look at them. So right now I'm looking at what I'm calling like layering technology. You know, can we go in a direction where we look at a piece of tech and kind of like the way Apple used to design their computers, right? Where once it became outdated, you can find the component that was outdated and swap it out with something. Is that possible in a classroom? Or do we have to kind of buy into this whole package that costs us so much money? And then 5 years from now, we're starting from scratch. So I don't necessarily have an answer of how we're going to do it yet. It's just, I think we're asking right now, is it possible? Is it possible to future-proof the classroom? Is it possible to read the tea leaves, so to speak, to look far enough into the future with where tech is going, to be able to know what trends are going to pick up in education.
That's really tricky, Heather, because technology, if we're good, if we can actually know what's happening next year, sometimes.
Well, I mean, you know, education is slow too. You know, when
yes, you've got one fast and one slow kind of married to each other. Yeah.
Just to intervene there for a second, it brings to mind something that we use in my end of the world, and that's to look at standards. And having worked on some of the early prototype team-based learning classrooms, 7 years ago, we tried to define things in what we call performance standards. Mm-hmm. And by talking about performance and what different things are capable of doing as in the interface between the technology and the users, as opposed to the actual, you know, spec for this type of camera or that type of computer. And so I think if we go back to the whole idea of future proofing, I think performance standards don't change too much over time, although I think our expectations change over time. But the actual equipment that we actually specify changes. But as long as we go back and rely on performance criteria as we go through this, then I think the kinds of things that Heather does, the kinds of things that Loretta do, can be perhaps not exactly future-proof, but at least less changeable.
Loretta, you know, this is singing your tune.
Yes.
The idea of museums for a very long time have been wrestling with that idea of flexibility, right? Not having a huge cost of changing out a major exhibit. You know, particularly in an art museum world. Can you talk about what that means for you in that context?
Yeah, well, you know, I just thinking about the notion of future, I really think that artists are the harbingers of things to come. All artists, as a curator, I've worked with artists on a local, regional, national, and international level. All artists are thinking, you know, beyond the confines of the studio. They're out there. They're grappling with the issues and ideas of our time, and think about our university, which is a research university. So, you know, how wonderful it is to be able to work with the artists of our time and the most recent research that's occurring. You know, in terms of technology, it's fascinating. The silver lining in this pandemic has been the fact that there we are to we're capable of doing live chats with artists and have a community of people listening into these artists and our scholars. We have the artists and scholars in conversation and having a global audience out there. We never thought of doing it until recently. And most recently, this is the even better good news, is that we are back in person. And we just last week had an event where it was a live in-person event, but we did live stream. So we were able to capture both people in our audience, the spontaneity of, you know, having the speakers and Q&A and live stream. So, you know, in the best of all worlds, I think we're gonna continue that. Even once we can do fully open events, we will do live chats and streaming, and just to be able to capitalize on an audience and the Q&A, that merging of artists, scholars, general public. Where better than at a museum can you really bring, at a university museum, at a contemporary art museum, to bring all of those constituents together.
Are you seeing an increase in people worldwide that attend now?
Yes, absolutely. Because the artists, I mean, whoever the speakers are, they have their own network. They notify their network that I'm speaking tomorrow to this well-known artist coming in from LA. And so we have an LA audience, a local audience, you know, it's global. And this is a reach we never really had before. Although I think our reputation does have a reach, but nonetheless.
I agree. You still had to come there, so.
That's right. So it is, well, Museum Without Walls, truly.
Yeah,
but I just want to say that we are still old school. You know, everything could be done digital, but when you're looking at a work of art, there's nothing that replaces the absolute, you know, need to see the artwork up close. You know, just this past year, we had 8,000 people looking at our collection digitally, studying it, researching it. But, you know, to be able to have that cathartic experience to see the art in person. So do I call ourselves old school? I don't know, but you know, this one-on-one looking at the art, even though we have a global audience, going back to this idea of one-on-one with the art and the viewer is so important.
Loretta and I are prioritizing right now. It's a very active program that we're both very interested to push, and that's to enhance the availability of the significant art collection that has not been very accessible, on the belief that looking at the actual original art is really important for students and for learning. And I don't know how you further articulate that, Loretta, but you know, looking at things even on the best art history projector on the wall, you know, isn't the same as looking at the actual work, you know, in real life. I don't know how you can say that from your point of view.
Well, it's all about close looking, and not only close looking for the artist or the art historian, but you know, pre-med students need to look closely at an art object to see what, you know, just to be able to see what's happening here. Students and faculty from all disciplines need to really have that one-on-one. It really is about close looking and looking at the medium itself and being able to determine, you know, the artist's touch or maybe absence of touch, all of that. It's an interpretation that you really can't always have through a digital image.
Yeah, and you've got that bridge, right? Between it, you're bridging that, because when you bring on the other, sometimes really the environment where you try to see a work of art gets in the way. There's too many people. You can't get up close and see it. You can't examine it. So, you know, you've got both. There is wonderful idea of seeing size and context that. However, you've got the other one where I can't in depth look at it, and the lighting is not always that great intentionally. So it's one of those that's, Tom, you're gonna.
Oh, I was just thinking, I'm not fully aware, Loretta, of how much 3D work is in the collection yet. I think it maybe is mostly a print and sort of 2D work, but I was most impressed years ago going to the Getty Villa and seeing that they had, because they have such incredible, delicate, you know, Greek urns and things like that, that they had digitized, because you can't have everybody handling them or turning them around, and that they had done these amazing, maybe they were leaders in that field, I don't know, to allow you to look at the object, but then to actually see it by rotating it digitally. Is that something that's kind of a hot way of seeing and knowing art in your world?
Well, I guess because our museum, we have a little over 4,000 works of art on paper, prints, drawings, and photographs. So we have a very few three-dimensional objects, but I think other museums are really exploring that clear need to be able to go 360 degrees around an artwork. So it's a new technology in that area is always being developed, and other museums are far more advanced than we are in that. We hope, as you know, Tom, we have some Native American pottery, and we're acquiring a few works, edition works that are three-dimensional. So down the road, it would be important for us to be able to have.
I see it going in that direction a lot. You know, it reminds me of a show I actually just watched, a documentary based on antiquities in ancient Egypt. And now there's this new push right now for archaeology, artifacts in Egypt to bring tourism back into the country. So what are they doing? They're using new technology. And some of the stuff is so old that they can't touch it. So they go in with these high-rise cameras and take these three-dimensional scans of them. And the part that interested me was they had all of these human eyes in this room. And everyone was looking at it and scanning it. But when they looked at the 3D image, they noticed something that they didn't notice with their eyes. And they went back into the space and found a remarkable discovery based on a 3D image, which you can see the value of it. But I think the downside of it for arts and education that typically don't have money to spend on multi-million dollar technology is that it's expensive and that it's changing. You know, you have to have these scans that can look at things and pick up the cracks. And for me, at least for artwork, when I'm looking at it, what moves me is the texture of it and being able to see the brushstrokes. And I think for me, even being a technologist, like, are there things in this world that we'll be able to capture in the same way to make it feel like my own two eyes are looking at it? And if I wanted to, I could reach out and touch it and feel it. Yeah.
You know, Heather, I'm interested too. You were talking earlier, and the part of that fits into this. You know, how do you maintain the social aspect? And you were talking about that. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to see it with our own eyes is one. Being able to see it within the context of a group where people might be whispering something that is interesting and helpful. You know, that's one of the neat gallery kinds of feels. Is or where are people going and how long are they staying reading something? Sometimes it helps guide me. How do we maintain that in education, not just in a museum, but that was how you started. So I was just curious.
Well, I mean, it's been something that academics have been grappling with for a while, right? And you've seen us trying to do it. I mean, we have makerspaces. Makerspaces are going in and being able to touch things with your hands and interact with it in a group atmosphere. And how do you do that? You know, the big question now is how do you replicate the community feel that happens in a face-to-face classroom? You know, how do you do that in an online or a virtual classroom? And, you know, I think a lot of that is, you know, connecting people to one another. And, you know, can you do it in a way like, does it happen in a classroom? You know, does it happen where, you know, I lean over my shoulder and say something to Loretta that's kind of pertinent to what's happening? It got me thinking about something. I know a lot of times we're in a conversation, you get a thought and you want to be able to articulate it. But when you're in a classroom face to face, sometimes you can't do that because it's not conducive to that. But in an online room, you could do it. I mean, right now I could be having a whole side conversation with Tom or Loretta based on something someone else said by chat. You know, with Zoom. So you're bringing in that social aspect that I think has disappeared a little bit from, especially classrooms in higher ed, you know, the seminar and lecture type classrooms, because you're not giving that opportunity always to allow a student to grapple with the concept or allow them to engage in a little critical thinking, you know, and it always, as an educator, it was always like, you know, you don't want talking in the class while I'm talking, don't talk. But you almost do, right? And in an online classroom, you can almost have it happening without it interrupting anyone else. But then there's the constraint of how do I make sure it's just not happening between Heather and Loretta all the time? And how do I share what we're talking about with the larger group? And that's when it gets tricky because then you're talking about privacy. Then you're talking about you know, do I have to censor things in case something inappropriate comes up? So it's something that we're talking about all the time. And if you came and followed me for a day or a week through my job, you would see how many times social presence and faculty presence and community engagement in online and virtual environments comes up. And we can go to the basic ones, right? Oh, discussion forums and you can have a Google Doc with a collaborative, but what's the next level? We're dealing with a whole nother generation of people that Google Doc is, you know, they equate it to Facebook, which is now technology for older people. So how do we kind of keep going forward and building this community, building this engagement, building this social presence, monitoring it, making sure it's conducive to learning, but also protect our students at the same time in those spaces?
That's a really great answer. Tom?
I've been observing for a long time, you know, I think about those of us who were a little on the older side I remember having to go find a Carol back in the back of the stacks of the library in order to study, you know, and I think those of us, you know, in that generation, of course, the universities didn't have these larger open kind of shared study spaces. And there was this kind of, I think we're learning now, misconception, you know, that you had to go hide at the back of the stacks and have a quiet place with no interruption. And you look at what we've learned and what we're doing now. In fact, I'm putting out an RFP today on a big new engineering building. We're purposely building into our designs places where people can have serendipitous interactions with one another on a face-to-face basis. And yet very often we are now learning to sort of combine that the importance of face-to-face, real, live, sit across a table from each other, even if you're both staring at a computer screen half the time. But there's something that I've just become to see is kind of magical almost about the face-to-face part of it that is essential. And yet these students who are thriving in these places that you might in the past have called noisy or full of distractions. There's some interesting to me, this phenomenon that students prefer that environment today. They're not seeking to hide at the back of the stacks as we used to do. So what's that all about? And I just want to transition back to you guys, Heather and Loretta, about that, because my eyes got opened when we started doing the experimental prototypes for team-based learning classrooms 7 years ago. And I was so worried, we put 90 students in one room, and I thought that the background noise would be just so great that our prototype would be a failure. And yet it wasn't. If you went in and observed the students, they were happily chatting away, you know, 9 people to a table, interacting very vigorously on problem solving, who were like 5 feet from the next table. They were also interacting vigorously and talking. And yet it somehow, why does that work so well when we didn't, you know, why is that a new idea? I don't know.
Yeah, Tom, I like to think of a museum as the biggest classroom on campus because it's a way that, and we encourage conversation and we have, it's sometimes noisy because we have videos going, video with sound in one room and it filters into the other room, which maybe isn't always, you know, pleasing to the artist who's in the other room, but we do have that aspect. We have interactive iPads where we want to bring students to, you know, they're looking at the art, they're talking about the art. We bring in lively conversations. But on the iPads, they can actually interactive way to find out more about the exhibition, more about the artist. So it's we're trying to create a lively environment that replicates, you know, what students are used to with one sound and video coming from one room and then the iPad and another space with the exhibitions, but not to, you know, interfere with the actual looking for those who do want to have the privacy of just kind of viewing on their own. But we really encourage conversation, and then we train our student, we call them our visitor attendants, not guards, but we really train them to speak to our visitors, whether it's, you know, someone coming from the community, a faculty student. So what did you think? Can I offer you any information? Did you know this artist does that? And by the way, there's a work over there. So it's, we want to bring that out. That's what we feel, especially at a university, that kind of conversation needs to happen in what's normally considered a, you know, a temple of quiet.
It's funny, you know, just thinking about that, when Tom, when you were talking about, you know, even back when I was in school, I did the same thing. I found a spot, and actually I used to go to the museum on campus and sit on a bench and do a lot of my work and writing, because it was quiet, but I was also in a space that, you know, felt, I felt engaged with. So I wasn't just sitting in a room. But the point I want to make is we were always quiet. We were always taught that learning needs to happen in a quiet environment. And now, like your point is, learning kind of happens in a little bit of a chaotic environment. Is it controlled chaos? Sometimes, you know, but I look at my nephews. I have an 8-year-old nephew and a 5-year-old nephew. And they are probably pretty on par with their tech skills that where I am. But I watch them having a conversation, playing a video game, and checking some other device at the same time. And they are somehow giving 100% of their attention or understanding, you know, what's happening on all three instances. You know, you try to challenge them a couple times, being like, you weren't listening. What did I say? And then they repeat it back, like verbatim. And is it a change in the way that our brains work due to growing up with technology? Is it a slow shift, right? Education is slow. Is it the slow shift going from independent learning to social learning? And we've just dragged technology with us. Has technology pushed us in that direction? I just find myself thinking a lot about that. Like, I would never have been able to learn in this environment. I need quiet. And students these days, whether it's in a museum, same thing, you would walk into a museum and it would be quiet and contemplation. And now you hear discussion and you hear, you know, art that has video and sound and music and all of these things. Just something that I find, I wonder which one came first. You know, it's like a chicken or the egg scenario.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question that you're asking, Heather. This conversation has this whole element of, you know, the past, the present, the future. How do we think about education? How do we think about learning? How do we think about things that have happened with our youth as opposed to others? And what are the ideas in terms of design that can help enhance that and do all that all the way across? We're talking with Thomas Hoof and Loretta Yarlow and Heather Sharp Smith. And please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Thomas Hoof, Loretta Yarlow, and Heather Sharp Smith about the whole idea of future-proofing. And when we took the break, there was this just burning kind of a question or idea that was in my head, and that was this whole idea about, you started, Heather, this chicken and the egg. Did we force learners into a mode which historically was quiet, but that wasn't how they really were? And did schools and places, you know, libraries, museums, make it that was the way you had to think of learning? And now are we just releasing kids? I kind of am interested in what your thoughts are, Heather.
I mean, you're tapping into a lot of the things that I'm actually working through in my day-to-day job right now, which is, you know, what do we do? I mean, do we shift how we teach, or do we shift the rooms that we teach in? Do we shift the tools that we teach with, or the content that we're teaching? It's kind of a hard one to answer and kind of put my finger on, because you know, when you throw the word innovation into the mix, even technology into the mix, there's so many different definitions from so many different people about what that means. So there's so many varying opinions on this that I think that's probably why we can't figure out what came first. There's so many arguments about, you know, generations and, you know, digital natives versus, you know, folks that weren't born with technology, and are they at a disadvantage? And there's so many differing opinions about that. And I think I'm the one that kind of disagrees and says, I don't think age has anything to do with it. I think the environment we're in has a lot to do with it. If you're in an area like a university, or you're working in a museum, or you are living in a city where you have more contact with kind of more innovative technologies or more modern ways of doing things, I think that at any age that can affect how you teach, how you learn, and what technology you feel comfortable with. Not sure if that kind of answers the question, but it's kind of where my thought went when you were talking about.
Well, it kind of touches on, I've just started a new committee to get better data on the different kinds of cohorts that we actually are serving in our university. And it's very interesting to me that there's been a lot of talk about those issues, and just as there's been on kind of the last 20 years of understanding that people, there are more than one or two ways of learning, which I think is the way traditional teaching went. You know, there was the teacher in the front of the classroom, whether you're talking about third grade or 12th grade or universities. And that realization has been relatively new in coming to us. But I think the new one that connects with the UMass new Flex Learning Initiative, which is the hottest new thing at UMass, by the way. And I sort of asked the question, well, who is it that's doing the learning? And we're starting to ask ourselves, it relates to this whole thing of lifelong learning. And that to me connects very closely to future proofing. Curricula come and go. And I think this whole new wonderful idea that let's not get so hung up on curricula and how many 500 facts you have to know by the time you take the test, but learning how to learn. And that, to me, that's future-proofing. But then to reach out and say, because we're talking a lot about the so-called demographic cliff, where we universities like us used to depend on those kids that graduated from high school and can't do that anymore. So this whole future-proofing via thinking about who our learners really are, we've just, in our committee, just come up with really wanting to look at how many learners do we have that come in that are over 35. We've had a really good debate about what ages, what types, and what needs different cohorts might have in connecting to learning. So that's kind of what we're doing right now. So I don't know how that connects to your constituencies, Loretta or Heather, but
yeah.
I think it's exciting to think that we're addressing the wider variety of the people coming through our doors.
And Tom, it's not only people coming through our doors. I guess we have two shadow museums. We have our museum, where of course we're always loving to have our visitors come through in person. Then we have our online museum. All of our exhibitions since 1975 are archived, our collections are archived. One could do all the work and studying just on our website. It's another museum. And then we have, I mean, I guess we're piggybacking on University Without Walls. I was calling it Museum Without Walls, where we do outdoor projects, outdoor public art. It's all based on, you know, temporary installations where we want to extend the art experience into the larger community, not only on campus, but we did an exhibition called Crosstown Contemporary Art. We commissioned artists outside our museum to do really extending from the university into the town of Amherst. So it brought, and we were able to extend that for about half a year. So thinking about, you know, bringing the art out into the constituents that we have, at least within our region. We even went as far as one year, we did something in Springfield. These three areas are so critical. So we, you know, are in person, people coming into the museum, maybe a one-on-one experience, the global information center that we have, and bringing art into the real world, so to speak, which many artists, of course, so many artists would be thrilled to think about ways that their art could extend to these communities. And the art is often dealing with the environment in which we're placing the art, whether it be, you know, in the rural and the more urban. So it's an exciting time, really, to think about how it's all piggybacking. It's all relevant. The artists are thinking along these lines. The museum is, and being, again, part of a university that's future thinking, new technology, always trying to improve the website, all the bells and whistles as to what a website can do is quite remarkable. And we're just at the beginning of what we need to do with an online program.
Yeah, I think what you're both talking about is this idea, when we think of website, we think of learning, we think of those things. We before repurposed university material or museum material, and we repurposed it from written, printed material and stuck it on the web. And we made it a print medium. And now what we're talking about is very different than that. So we're talking about designing virtual places on the web that capture the realities of your experience in a museum. And that, to me, that's very cutting edge to try to think of how do we create these virtual environments that are not a web page and not a text page. And that is a super big challenge because few of us are really, of us of our age have been prepared to figure that out. But I love the idea.
To be able to zoom in and out of the artwork, to really get up, get your nose up close to the artwork.
Yes.
And I was told that, you know, some of the real estate developers, some of those, you know, House Beautiful, if they want to sell your house, you find this incredible technology that people can actually zoom in and out of your cupboards, your drawers. It's so they're a little bit more advanced. That's the kind of technology a museum would love to have, you know, be able to rotate around a room and to really zoom right into an artwork so close that, you know, if you're really in a museum, you can't put your nose against the glass, so to speak.
We have a school of design with an architecture, landscape, and technology program. I employ most every semester two graduate students. And one who is particularly amazing to me, who just graduated, we couldn't hold on to him any longer. He was launching into the world. He did a thesis project that just blew my socks off, that was basically finding a site on campus that was open. He designed a virtual building for people to inhabit virtually as a place to sit. We were talking about places to study and do things. He just took that to the extreme, that was a place that didn't exist, but would make people feel good to be in virtually in order to either interact with one another or to study or do things. And it was just like a whole other new world he opened up. On the fact that in some cases you might not even have to build a building, but you can actually create places, virtual places for people to inhabit individually or together.
Tom, was astounded. You're now touching upon my career, my field, which is, you know, instructional design. And it's funny because you articulated so well, both you and Loretta right now, about the need for designing a space. And, you know, Tom with classrooms, Loretta with art gallery space, you know, but for some reason, the virtual classroom, people don't think there is a need for it to be designed. Or they don't understand what that means. You know, there's often times when you try to work with people to say, you know, partner with an instructional designer. Oh, no, I know how to set up my class. And what does it end up looking like? It ends up looking like that web page. It looks like a page of text that as a student, if I'm excited, you know, I've read a course description, I've signed up for this course, I'm like, oh my gosh, this looks so interesting. I've heard so many great things about this faculty member. And then I log on to the class and the first thing I see is just a wall of text. Does that kill engagement, you know, right away? And, you know, how can we design the virtual classroom to have the same impact and that the face-to-face classroom has? Same question, how do we design a virtual museum to have the same impact? Wouldn't it be awesome if you were in a virtual classroom and I could just zoom in on one of you and just interact with you and just kind of say, oh, you know, the same way I would reach over my shoulder, you know, to whisper something to you, you know, so designing the classroom or the virtual classroom and instructional design and design learning is so important because, you know, being able to organize, being able to scaffold, being able to create interactions in a virtual environment is I think what we need to start embracing in order to future-proof the virtual classroom.
So you hit on something just, I think, absolutely key, Heather, and that is the role of design in that. That's the background all of you come from. And I think we knew a lot of things, like when someone developed the idea of Photoshop, it was developed out of a metaphor that was a pasteboard and a table, which don't exist really in many worlds anymore, and they don't have to. But it was a way of creating a context that works so you don't feel lost. And so when I think about designing going into a place, it needs an architect.
Absolutely.
Right?
It needs an architect
to design the virtual space, because we need the same thing. It needs a curator to think just as much as they do on how they place things in context and what you see and first and what you see second or what's more prominent. It takes a curator. It takes an educator to figure out, how do I motivate you without text? You know, our best form of interpretation, we all know, is a person. But shy of that, those are expensive. And so people are expensive to have in our galleries. We would love, and I know, Loretta, you're doing a great stuff with getting other people trained, you know, that would be the people that are in the galleries, that they have a little pieces of information, but we could even go further. So this is really exciting stuff. Go ahead, Laura.
Well, just about to say that we're, you know, by working with grad students who are in these different fields and having internships and graduate assistantships, we have been able to develop what, I mean, maybe for lack of a better word again, a microsite for our exhibitions. This was designed by one of our grad students. And it's just, it's a website within the website. So each exhibition has a microsite. And we never had that before. It's beautifully interactive. You can hear video by the artist, read the tech, read reviews, see the artwork, hear the artist. So that's something we never would have had if we hadn't had a whole bevy of really brilliant grad students at our fingertips. They get, you know, course credit. So it's reciprocal. They get the great training, could go on to great careers in the museum world and elsewhere. But so it's just, again, the beginning of what we're hoping to do in terms of developing these mini sites within our site.
The work that we did about 4 years ago, when we took a dive and had some consultants work with us on the whole issue of class laboratories. That exercise really opened my eyes to a few things, because we had been watching, those of us who have to deal with, I'm sorry about my phone. We had been watching the, because I deal a lot with sort of student demographics and that kind of thing, and this sort of nationwide decline and in the enrollment or the interest in the humanities. And I, maybe not so much the arts, but certainly in the humanities, where the numbers are just going down and the numbers in the STEM fields are going up. And you can say, is it savvy students who just are tuned in to the outside world and knowing where the jobs are going to be when they graduate? You might say that's one explanation. But what was very interesting in that whole process of looking at where things are was learning, and partly from your world, Loretta, but also in theater and the people that share your building. I'm very sorry about this. Realizing that the dynamic sort of growth areas in some of the humanities has to do with, for example, theater kids who are combining with tech savvy kids, you know, the use of technology in on the stage and sort of combining the kids that are good at electronic music with the kids that are good at computer stuff to do virtual scenery for the back of a theater. And then the whole combination of arts and technology just, oh, I suddenly went, oh my God, that's where the future of humanities is. And I don't know what you think about that.
Well, Tom, one of the things I wanted to ask you along those lines is, Is anybody involved in at the architectural level and designing the campus at to be both online and the other? In other words, I wonder, it still feels like it's siloed to me. It still feels like we have architects and people working on buildings who have no sense of working on the fuller part. And then we have people that are instructional technologists working on something else. So, if to me, this is the great opportunity to put that design, those designers, those architects to work on thinking of what is the campus? It's not a building anymore. It has a building, but what's the role of the building and what's the role of the other? Because you're going to have blended learning happening everywhere. Do you see that happening anywhere?
I think the most exciting thing that I'm involved in is Heather and I are on this committee of campus instructional technology. And during the meeting, the conversation is all about where we prioritize the next technology. But to me, it's exactly what you just said, Mark. I'm sitting there thinking as an architect, listening to and learning every week a little more about, you know, the technology side that I know something about and through the team-based learning initiatives that we've done. But I just find that I like, and I think more of us should be doing exactly what you just said, connecting those two pieces, which I think, you know, all of us, I think on this, Heather and Loretta and I are all doing in different ways. But there's one little twist I'd like to sort of throw out to folks, and that's just, I think the pandemic that we've just gone through, and there's a presumption when we talk about virtual and blended, that we're talking about people who are physically in one place relating to people who are physically in another place. And I'm going back and thinking the initiatives that we did with team-based learning to me are still very exciting, because it's there, I feel like it's more about looking at the social aspect that Heather and Loretta were talking about earlier, but using technology right there at the table facing one another and drawing on technology live as part of a conversation. And when we did the first prototypes, we said we spent a lot of money on technology for making it accessible for group study at each table. And we thought, oh, that's too much technology. We'll find out which ones they use and don't use, and then we'll cut back and make things cheaper. We found everybody at some point used all of what we thought was excessive technology creatively, not everybody using it all the time, but they had all these things at their fingertips. So it was more about, I don't know how what you guys in the teaching end of things that do this, because I don't teach, would say about that, but it's more putting having like nodes of technology where people sitting and thinking together and working together can quickly just pick up and use stuff to document their conversations, to share it with people, other people in the room. But it's very different in my mind from this kind of pandemic blended learning kind of thing that assumes people are far away from each other. There's something really important about that social stuff.
Tom, that's great. We're going to come back in just a few minutes, but I want to encourage the listeners to listen to this broadcast and to find things in there that you find of interest and to open your own conversations with people in your respective settings, because what we're talking about is really what the future of how people might learn and how they might engage with one another. We'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Thomas, Loretta, and Heather about really, I think, some very exciting ideas about design and about future and about how we learn. And it really strikes me what's really important, Loretta, as I'm a museum professional, and I still believe the object is so important to us, the ability to use all of our senses on something. And so I know that's kind of where you are. So I don't want us to go off on this tangent that it's all going to be virtual. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, I feel I'm the anchor of the, you know, old school way of thinking, but clearly, you know, we're a training museum, a teaching museum. And so having, you know, the opportunity for hands-on work, to have, you know, students and even visitors come in, they can make appointments to, at the present time, the collection is not open to the public, but, you know, to be able to handle the work, just put on the white gloves and be able to move art around and look at it. And so, as Tom knows, as Tom has initiated the possibility of our creating a larger center for us to bring our works on paper out there for the public viewing. you know, it's great to think about ways we could bring together around a table looking at one artwork, the philosopher, the pre-med student, the artist, someone in environmental studies, all talking, looking at one thing, handling one thing, talking, all of these disciplines come into focus. That's the excitement that I have working at a museum. You know, I'm bringing the general public in as well to have the conversations and maybe to videotape the conversation. So that there's a longer life just than what one has around the conference table there.
That's really great. And I think, you know, I think Heather, I can tell that, you know, that's what you're trying to figure it out. What is the balance of how we do that and how maybe the group that's at the table can be the hands, the ears and the eyes and the senses for somebody that's virtual so that we could be learning together in that same space. Those are all there. One area that we haven't talked about, but all of this really makes some sense is, you know, it's really important that we figure out ways to deal with equity. And who has access to things and who doesn't. And Loretta, you began to open that door by the Museum Without Walls idea, in addition to the museum, but how do those kinds of things open us to new audiences, help us rethink and learn from our new audiences? Anybody want to tackle that one?
Sure. Well, I could just mention that we, you know, when we do our outdoor projects, we really think of ways that we can involve an artist who already is either in that community or working in media that would be referencing things that are in that area. So, you know, site specificity is really what one needs to be all about. You're specific to a community, you're specific to an area, a locale, just, you know, in square footage. That's how we try to make the art as meaningful as possible to create this kind of diversity and equity, inclusivity. It's about the specificity of our location and where the art occurs and where the conversation takes place.
Great.
Heather? You know, it's interesting, you know, I wrote down the words equity and access. And these are two words that I say a million times in a day. Because, you know, as soon as you bring in technology into the picture, with whatever you're doing, you're creating access to more people. So you're expanding, you know, beyond your local environment. But you're also, now you're also expanding what you have to pay attention to is by expanding my audience, I now have people who are not the same, meaning someone might have, you know, not be able to see, someone might not be able to hear, somebody might not be able to interact and touch. So how do I build an equitable and accessible place now that I've kind of expanded? So technology is the answer, right? But sometimes it's funny. So technology is for accessibility and for equity. It's giving something to someone who might not have been able to get it. But then it's also the wall, right? Because not everyone for socioeconomic reasons might not have the ability to connect virtually. And now we have to look at our design. It's much like architecture, right? Universal design has now been adapted into learning, universal design for learning, same concept. You know, I have to kind of figure out a way to build in the sidewalk cutouts into a virtual learning so anyone can access and get into this room and learn equally. And I think that's what kind of drives everything that we do. You know, I'd love to say that it was design and like, you're going to get a really good slick looking course and it's going to be really pretty and have great colors. But at the same time, I have to be really careful about all of that too. So it's interesting, but you know, while I was thinking about that too, I was going back to what you said to Loretta before about relating. And that's really what we're trying to do, right? Is get a whole bunch of different people to relate to the same thing. In some way. And how do you build a relationship between virtual and in-person? And I think less a comment and more, I think I liked what you said about, you know, having the folks in the room be the eyes and the ears. And then the folks that are in the virtual environment are kind of, you know, using their senses almost to bring them into the brick and mortar space. It got me thinking, I'm writing down a bunch of things about what I can do in this area now to play on that topic.
Can't wait to collaborate with you.
I know, I'm excited.
it's really great. And, you know, encouraging people to have these kinds of conversations, you know, with, again, with different disciplines and different experiences at the table, I think is absolutely critical. Tom, when you, you know, as an architect, that is really one of the strengths that really good architects have, and that is being able to bring people together around the idea of creating and the design. Can you talk a little more about how that it can be done in something like this? How might you approach this?
I think I'm just thinking about the experiences and the kinds of directions that we've gone in, you know, in the recent work I've done. As Heather kind of alluded to, you know, it's the internal architecture equivalent of the sidewalk cuts in the sidewalk to make everybody be able to get over the curb. It makes me think about, as we were talking, how 15 years ago when we were first doing some of these ideas about using technology, we in fact had kind of painful conversations about equity, because we said not everybody has an Apple, you know, and we're talking here as a public university, where, you know, scholarship students came in and not everybody even had to think about how fast we've gone forward. We had to talk about not everybody even has a cell phone back, you know, 15 years ago. And the fact that much of this technology at the university level, even here where we have, you know, plenty of scholarship students, you can almost assume that, you know, 98% have their own laptop and their own cell phone that can access all this stuff, but we still have a little bit of an equity issue to deal with there that wasn't nearly as bad during the pandemic as when you read, you know, the kids in rural poor counties that barely even had an internet connection. So we're looking at, I think, on our end, the fact that a place like UMass can fill in the gap when there's still a small percentage of people that don't have access, and that we're able to help fill that gap in ways about having shared resources for people to borrow, just like you have a library for borrowing books, you have a library for borrowing technology. I like the idea of thinking now we're creating, I don't know, neutral technology enabled boxes, you might say. The less, I think we're looking to being less specialized than we were before, and creating the architecture should be fairly neutral and changeable, and that the people within it, whether it's laboratories, you know, our standard for laboratories, you think of laboratories as being fixed kinds of things, but our teaching labs in particular, we're making everything movable, except the fume hoods, which, you know, have legal requirements to be fixed. But we're looking at making everything as movable and changeable as possible to encourage as much collaboration as possible, whether it's a laboratory or a classroom. And that's how we're thinking about making things both future-proof, but also responsive to the kinds of new pedagogical things that folks in Heather's and Loretta's world are asking us to do.
I think that is, you know, a great wrap-up, Tom, to our conversation for today. We could talk so much more about this, and probably will in the future. I want to thank my guests, Thomas Hoof, Loretta Yarlow, and Heather Sharp-Smith, for helping us explore the world of the future in design and thinking. If you liked what you heard today, you can go to the website at thedaVinciPursuit.com, where we'll have other episodes, as well as this one, for you to listen to into the future. Until then, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you, again, to tune in next week, where we will explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.